It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome again to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Today on our program, defining Obama's foreign policy. Now, 6 years into his administration, President Obama has proposed a reset with Russia, a pivot to Asia, outreach to the Muslim world, and renewed effort to build respect across international lines. He forcibly helped remove Libya's Muammar Gaddafi from power, gave Egypt's Hosni Mubarak a shove out of office, and most recently welcomed Ukraine's newest president, Petro Poroshenko, after his predecessor fled to Russia, setting off one of the worst crises in recent European history. His administration has helped welcome the first hopeful signs of democratization in Myanmar, also known as Burma, and also strengthened ties with the burgeoning economic powerhouse of Indonesia. But he has also largely stood on the sidelines during the bloody 4-year Syrian civil war, and so far at least has proven unable to bring the Palestinians and Israelis any closer to a working peace agreement. And that's not even counting Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea, Somalia, escalating tensions in the South China Sea, religious conflict in the Sahel. I could go on. All of this begs the question, 6 years in, what successes can this White House point to in foreign affairs? And what exactly are the broad foreign policy goals of the Obama administration? Does it even have a definition beyond the famous summation, don't do stupid stuff, more or less? Well, joining us this half hour to share their thoughts, it's a pleasure to welcome both here in Washington, D.C., Colonel P.J. Crowley. He's a fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication at the George Washington University. In President Obama's first term, Mr. Crowley served as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. He also served in President Clinton's administration. Mr. Crowley is a retired Air Force colonel. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also, Colonel Stephen Bucci joins us. He's director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Mr. Bucci served in the Army Special Forces before being named military assistant to then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in the Bush administration. Mr. Bucci is also an adjunct professor of leadership at George Mason University and associate professor of cybersecurity policy at Long Island University. He is a retired Army colonel. Welcome to you, sir.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Two great guests with an extraordinary amount of background. So let's put first the question to both of you. Mr. Bucci, I'd like to begin with you. You'll both have a crack at this. How would you concisely articulate this president's foreign policy?
Somewhat disheveled. Admittedly, President Obama has faced a lot of challenges, some pretty daunting ones during his time in office. And to be honest with you, I don't think he's addressed them all that well, and there are a lot of people would say that the lack of active leadership on the part of the administration has in fact contributed to some of the challenge that he's facing.
P.J. Crowley, I imagine you might choose a different word than somewhat disheveled.
I think what President Obama has tried to do is to reestablish a foreign policy that employs all tools of foreign policy. Obviously, the military instrument remains very important. He inherited, three wars. He's tried to clarify those wars. Obviously, ended the Iraq War in 2011, at least the United States
involvement
element. Obviously, in recent months, there's been a renewed engagement inside Iraq. He will wind down the war in Afghanistan later this year. And he's tried to refocus what was called the War on Terror. He refocused that with regard to the war against al-Qaeda. And obviously, he has seen and is trying to adapt to an evolving threat that has moved from the core al-Qaeda, which is not anywhere near the factor it was a dozen years ago, to various al-Qaeda franchises that exist in Yemen, Somalia, and perhaps as far west as Nigeria. And then we obviously see this rising phenomenon, ISIS, which wants to be the as a rival and wants right. to be the successor, you know, to Al-Qaeda. As Steve said, it is arguably one of the most complex times in terms of foreign policy. The administration has made its share of mistakes, but is trying to move from a situation, you know, to where there are regional solutions to major challenges and trying to build genuine partnerships so that the United States is not the only one, you know, with the burden of leadership in the world.
Is it too early to be asking these questions? I almost feel like a schoolmarm asking for marks for a student. But obviously, this president has two more years in office and then some. Is it simply too early to be asking these questions?
No, I don't think it's ever too early to ask these questions about any president. I mean, that's the job of the press and the public, is to look at our elected officials and say how they're doing. And I think, you know, the folks who look at President Obama's foreign policy and really try and grade it by what they perceive as malintent towards America, or, you know, to take America down, I think are mistaken. I think he really, you know, tries to do what he believes is the right thing to do. And I kind of like getting to quote the Washington Post, which is a heritage analyst I don't get to do very much. But, you know, they said, you know, the president is pursuing a foreign policy based on the world he wishes was out there, not the one that really is. And I think that's turned out to be a problem for him.
Defining Obama's foreign policy, our topic this half hour on Encounter here on VOA. Our guests, P.J. Crowley and Stephen Bucci. Well, we'll make this concrete in a moment, because certainly there are enough specific examples of what the president has or has not done. But I am curious at first, just to lay this out for an outset, and first to you, P.J. Crowley, how important is it for a president to have a defined, articulated foreign policy? I'm speaking beyond kind of the broad, you know, kind of American goals of democratization, peace, that sort of thing.
Well, certainly any president comes into office with a worldview, with an idea of how he or she will wrestle with the issues at the time. The world does get a vote. You know, for example, at the start of the Bush administration, there was understandably a belief that the challenge in 2001 revolved around, you know, major power relationships. And ironically, as we see today, that very much right. you know, is the case. Obviously, when 9/11 occurred, that fundamentally changed, you know, the Bush presidency and the focus and priorities for that administration. And likewise, President Obama came in with some firm ideas about those same topics, some ideas about perhaps mistakes or excesses that his predecessors had made. And again, as Steve suggested, even as he aspires to help reshape a dramatically changing world, he is confronted with right. the world that is. And obviously, you know, for example, reflecting a policy reality for the United States, it is a Pacific power, it's an Asia power. And wanted to rebalance the attention that Asia gets, you know, in the foreign policy community. And yet, as we see, he continually exactly. drawn not just back to the Middle East, but now does, in fact, confront a fundamental challenge in terms of the U.S. relationship with Russia that we could not forecast in 2009.
Stephen Bucci, I'm wondering, this sounds a little familiar. How often is it that a president is, perhaps this may be too strong a word, but overtaken by world events as they're trying to craft and steer their foreign policy?
I think if you look back in history, it happens almost all the time. I mean, when as PJ mentioned, the Bush administration, when I first got to the Pentagon, you know, our marching orders were draw down all of these nation building things, all these deployments all over the world, the Sinai, Kosovo, Macedonia, all these places that the Bush administration thought, you know, the Clinton administration had gotten us involved in, and we were going to close all those down. And then suddenly after 9/11, it totally changed, and you know, we ended up way more places with way more people than before. And in the same way, when the Obama administration came in, they were bound and determined to fix what they felt had been done incorrectly under Bush. You know, my favorite example is Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that was a hard thing for the president. He said he was going to close it, and then you got in there and realized, gee, those silly guys in the last administration actually had a reason that they couldn't get rid of all of these bad guys, because mm-hmm. to be honest with you, we had all but about a dozen of them we thought we were done with. We were ready to send them someplace, but we found out either they refused to go to the countries that would accept them or nobody would accept them. And we were kind of stuck with what in the heck to do with them.
Well, the Congress stepped in and offered its own view.
Yeah, they added as well. It added to the difficulty, sure.
Exactly. Now, so let's make this a little real and take a look at perhaps just one of the game changers that may be on the table right now, namely the conflict in Ukraine. Now, of course, President Obama is this week at the NATO gathering in Wales. And before that, he stopped in Tallinn, Estonia, where he was addressing not only the Baltics, but obviously the world, speaking about Russia's aggression in, or what he says is Russia's aggression in Ukraine. And in this speech, he laid out what he clearly thinks is the cause and the root of the problem.
It was not the government of Kiev that destabilized eastern Ukraine. It's been the pro-Russian separatists who are encouraged by Russia, financed by Russia, trained by Russia, supplied by Russia, and armed by Russia. And the Russian forces that have now moved into Ukraine are not on a humanitarian or peacekeeping mission. They are Russian combat forces with Russian weapons in Russian tanks. Now, these are the facts. They are provable. They're not subject to dispute. As a result of state-run propaganda, many Russians have become convinced that the actions taken by their government is strengthening Russia. But reaching back to the days of the Tsars, trying to reclaim lands lost in the 19th century, is surely not the way to secure Russia's greatness in the 21st century.
P.J. Crowley, I'm hearing what sounds to me at least like an assertive president here, perhaps a little bit more assertive than I've heard him before. What did you just hear there?
Well, as NATO wrestles with what to do about Russia and the nature of its relationship going forward, you know, we are drawn back 20 years where NATO tried to fashion a new relationship with Russia, but recognize that we should hedge against a Russia that would try to regenerate itself in meaningful ways. This is the irony of the meeting that NATO leaders have had this week, is we keep on talking about a new NATO, and that's represented in the mission that NATO has carried on in Afghanistan for the last decade or more.
Exactly.
And yet, as you move from Western Europe, what Rumsfeld called the old Europe, towards the new Europe,
perhaps so.
This is exactly why these nations, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, join the NATO alliance. So we are drawn back to a different age. And what the challenge here is, as the president said, NATO will protect those countries in the alliance for which it has Article 5 responsibility.
Right.
It will find a way to continue to develop its partnership relationship with Moldova, Ukraine,
Georgia,
and Georgia. But obviously, this is a case where the most meaningful actions will need to be done in Europe, more so than the United States.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests, Stephen Bucci with the Heritage Foundation and P.J. Crowley with the George Washington University. This quick reminder, if you can't always catch us on the radio, you can hear Encounter online as a podcast. Just go to our website, voanews.com/encounter. We'd also very much like to hear your thoughts on today's topic. How would you define President Obama's foreign policy? Send those thoughts to us by email, encounter@voanews.com. Mr. Bucci, you just heard President Obama there. I described it as perhaps an assertive tone. What did you hear?
Well, I thought it was quite assertive, too. I think it was a great statement. I wish he had made it a few months ago. I'm always happy for improvements in our stance, and I think taking a harder line against Russia and calling them for what they're doing is the right thing to do. I think we probably could have done this a while ago and maybe forestalled some of the actions that have gone on. So I was very pleased with the president's comments, and I hope we and our NATO allies will follow that up with enough activities to make the message clear to Mr. Putin that we actually really mean what we just said.
Let's try and assess Mr. Obama's foreign policy. Perhaps it has been widely reported, as he characterized it himself using the now famous aphorism, don't do stupid stuff. P.J. Crowley, is that really enough to make a foreign policy? His former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, recently suggested that wasn't really a policy.
Well, it's not an organizing principle, and I think the president would fully agree with that. And it represents the aspect of you come into office with what you believe our lessons learned from the previous 4 years, 8 years, whatever the case may be. And yet in certain cases, as Steve suggested, there are policies that make sense and you want to continue. One of the areas where President Bush had very effective action was to reach an agreement between Sudan and South Sudan. Mm-hmm. President Obama picked up that mantle and ushered in the world's newest country in South Sudan. Now, there's plenty going on still in that venue, but the reality is that much of U.S. foreign policy is contiguous, because they're driven more by interest than they are by presidencies or personalities. That said, there are opportunities that do come out. The world does change. Things are created. Myanmar is a great example of where a door opened. Mm-hmm. The Obama administration has fundamentally changed the relationship between Burma and the West, based in large part on actions taken by the military junta in Burma, and obviously endorsed by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. And a lot of work will be done going forward to nurture that development. I think there's an appreciation, if you look at the experience of the last 10 or 15 years, that the one thing that presidents do learn over time is that change takes time. You have great opportunities, you try to pursue those opportunities, but in the case of many of these fragile states, failing states, building new institutions of government, building trend lines towards more inclusive democracy does take a generation. It can't be done in a 4-year period or an 8-year period. Iraq is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. Egypt is a good example of that. These are going to be challenges that stretch across administrations and will take decades before they really take root.
Stephen Bucci, where would you point to this president's successes? Where do they lie?
First, I just wanted to comment on the don't do stupid stuff line. To be fair to President Obama, that is sort of the bottom line for anybody in public office, particularly a president, is you got to minimize the really bad things that happen. That is sort of the safety net. I'm just giving him credit for at least having that in his head. I don't think it was the right line to use to describe what his foreign policy was. I think that was a public affairs mistake. And I think part of the problem is that the president is really not that comfortable with foreign affairs. He's much more comfortable with domestic issues. And it's almost as if, in some cases, the foreign affairs stuff sort of gets in the way of what he's really comfortable with. And I think that sort of affected some of his decisions to lay back a little more than an American president should. I'm not saying, we should be jingoistic or anything, but, the rest of the world, our allies and our enemies, look at the United States and sit there and wonder, well, what the heck are they going to do now? Because that affects everyone else's actions and positions. And I think the president has left a lot of folks sort of wanting as far as that goes. I think his outreach to Russia initially was probably a good idea. I think he stayed with it way longer than he needed to. And that has turned out poorly. And Mr. Putin, I think, has taken advantage of it. But I think his original idea was fine. His outreach to the Muslim world, I understand why he was doing that after 2 terms of pretty much straight conflict with the Muslim world. But again, there was a perception of a lot of outreach to people who had expressed dislike for us and sort of, well, all these people who are normally our friends, they'll still be our friends no matter what we do. I think that was a mistake. So again, I give him high marks for great intentions, for out-of-the-box thinking, but I think he let the ball drop as far as taking care of the foundational things that have served this nation well for multiple administrations of both parties.
Well, I have a slightly different take. The reset was directed at a very different Russia, a Russia led by Dmitry Medvedev. And the reset worked. The reset ended when Medvedev left and Putin returned to power with a much different agenda and a much different vision for Russia than Medvedev had. I think the outreach to the Muslim world was very, very important. The net effect in terms of perception, right or wrong, in the Islamic world of the so-called war on terror, whether it was a war on Islam, I think the outreach has helped to reset perception of that. Obviously, we see in ISIS today, they're trying to reignite that. perception once again. I think that President Obama has been very comfortable with foreign affairs. I disagree with Steve on that point, but he came into office with a fundamentally different political environment, both domestic and foreign, than President Bush had. You know, once you had 9/11, the deck was cleared for President Bush. He had a wide range of freedom of action and took advantage of that. Coming into office, I think, you know, not only, and we shouldn't forget, on top of managing three wars, you also had, you know, the economic recovery the United States is going through, the world is going through. And so, you know, to use a phrase from President Bush, you know, President Obama's just had less political capital. And what he's decided to do is to apply a much more stringent cost-benefit analysis in terms of where he's going to ploy American power, for what purpose, and for how long.
So let's take a look at that cost-benefit analysis, but a different situation. This time, the self-styled Islamic State, as they call themselves, or ISIL, as we've been referring to them, that spreads across portions of Syria and Iraq. Vice President Joe Biden, very recently up in at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, had this to say, really got the crowd going. He said, "We will follow them to the gates of hell until they are brought to justice, because hell is where they will reside." Stephen Bucci, what are you seeing in terms of how this president and this administration is responding to the threat posed by ISIL?
Well, with due respect to the vice president, I think that was a little bit overwrought. I thought we learned that lesson with some of the things that President Bush said that people realized were not necessarily helpful. Trust me, I would love to see those guys exactly in hell, because I think they're murderers. They're an embarrassment to their own proposed faith. But I'm not sure that was the right line to use. I think the administration is taking action there. I think that's positive. I'm not sure it's quite enough. I don't think we're going to get to the point where, you know, we're sending in infantry divisions and marine divisions again. I don't think that's wise. But I do think you need boots on the ground, but they don't necessarily have to be American boots. However, I think to provide the right leadership, you're probably going to have to take a snapshot of what we did in the early stage in Afghanistan, where you had our special operations forces embedded with the local ground forces, and then a lot of air power controlled by those special operators to really take this to ISIS. But at least, you know, we're inching towards it, and I hope that by inching towards it, we don't allow them to, you know, like sort of become a super infection by only medicating them a little at a time. I think we need to go in and take them out a little more robustly than what we're doing.
Of course, that's going to require some sort of broad strategy, I imagine. You can't obviously just put boots on the ground or indiscriminately bomb. And the president recently, in a news conference, stated that, well, when it comes to ISIL at this point, or the self-styled Islamic State, we really don't yet have a strategy. P.J. Crowley, does that concern you?
Well, I think there's time to build a strategy. No question the president has struggled with what to do about Syria for the past 3 years. I think he made a mistake a year ago when he had the opportunity to strike the Assad regime. And I understand why he hesitated, didn't think he had enough political legitimacy to take that action, did not have, you know, political support in this country and thin support around the world for that kind of action. You know, as Steve said, the United States has taken effective action in Iraq. That's a good start. Obviously, as Chairman Martin Dempsey, the Joint Staff, said, in order to deal with ISIS, you're going to have to eventually have effective action both in Iraq and across in Syria. I think the president's right to slow down the march regarding Syria till we not only have a strategy, but have a consensus within the region as to what to do, and have allies who are willing to, as Steve suggested, you know, put real skin in this game. But we also have to understand two things. I think it's something that it was a lesson that informed the thinking of the Bush administration over time, that while the United States has an important and meaningful role to play in this, that ultimately the decisive actions will be within the Islamic world in terms of how they interpret their religion and the kind of society they want to live in, you know, with support, you know, from the United States. And I think, secondly, that while there's a vital military aspect to this, there's also a very important political aspect to this. And I think what the president did in conditioning meaningful U.S. support to Iraq was to say, look, what has allowed ISIS to evolve into Iraq in the way it had, you know, were the destructive actions of the Maliki government. That government needs to perform better. The Iraqi security forces need to perform better. And there's reason, if you want to be optimistic, there's reasons to believe that if they do the things that they need to do, you know, we can see the same kind of Anbar moment in 2014, 2015 that we saw in 2006 and 2007, and then just begin to reduce the amount of oxygen that's available, you know, to ISIS, first in Iraq and eventually in Syria.
I gave the first word to Stephen Bucci, so I will give the last word to P.J. Crowley. But Stephen Bucci, briefly, as we wrap up here, it seems we've had doctrines attached to presidents dating back to Monroe, Truman Doctrine, Reagan Doctrine, Bush Doctrine. If you were asked and pressed to define it, would you say that there is a Obama Doctrine? And if so, what is it?
I would hesitate to say there's an Obama Doctrine, but I think there is an organizing principle of trying to remove America from being the sole leader of the foreign policy world. As a principle, that makes some sense, but I think in execution it has not worked out as well as the president would have liked, and I think the rest of the world is sitting there going, gosh, I wish these guys would take charge again because nobody else is. I think that's kind of been his guiding for his foreign policy.
P.J. Crowley?
I don't think there's an Obama Doctrine either, but I do think that that we've moved back to perhaps following many of the tenets of the Powell Doctrine, you know, and asking the same kinds of questions, very sensible questions. What is the national interest? Is it a vital interest? Are we tailoring the level of U.S. commitment to that interest? Do we have an exit strategy? Do we have partners? Do we have appropriate international and domestic support? These are important questions to be asked and answered, you know, to understand and balance, you know, what do we need to do? How can we make sure that the world will follow us where we feel we need to go, and that there's an idea in terms of what we're trying to achieve and how best to go about that?
This is a question I'd sorely like to have both of you back in about 2 years to take another look at this again. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week on Encounter. Thanks to you both for coming in and sharing your insights. Colonel P.J. Crowley, fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication at the George Washington University, and Colonel Stephen Bucci, director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Encounter was produced in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much to our producer, Anya Zalewski, and our engineer, Vasco Valerich. And for all of us here at VOA, thanks for spending some time with us. We'll be back with you again next week.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.